KLPW. This is Diane Jones. I'm joining you here. It's an FRIDAY Friday, Friday, Friday. Celebrated what beautiful weather we've had and continue to have. It's going to go in through the weekend too. And I love it. I hope you do as well. That was a little bad finger. And one of the very first groups, if not the first groups, that the Beatles on their Apple label signed on. Bad finger. And they sound a lot like the Beatles. Probably for a reason. Pretty successful formula that. And in the meantime, now a lot going on in our nation's capital. It's all about legislation. It's all about what is moving through Congress right now. And my next guest is here to talk about that. He is Stephen Sandher. He's CEO of the Associated General Contractors. And here to talk a little bit about the new PRO Act, the PRO Act. And without further ado, I welcome you to the program, Stephen. Good morning.
Good morning, Diane. Thanks for having me.
So the PRO Act, give me sort of the overall summary of what that bill is.
Sure, happy to. The PRO Act, the PRO, stands for Protect the Right to Organize, which is an acknowledgement that federal labor law gives employees the right to organize and bargain collectively. And no one has a dispute with that underlying principle of federal labor law. However, that innocuous title disguises a overall comprehensive rewrite of federal labor law that would damage employees, emerging businesses, and established businesses by giving unions unfettered leverage at the bargaining table, at the workplace, and beyond.
And then one of the things, I mean, and I know the issue has come up before with labor unions, the idea that if a shop is going to vote on organizing into a labor mm-hmm. union, those are supposed to be, you know, private elections, secret elections. They're
correct.
Not supposed to know who's voting, but they want to take that away.
Correct. And it's not that they want to take it away. They basically want to diminish the effectiveness of the secret ballot. So let me explain a little bit how that happens. So first of all, this bill would require employers to turn over to a union that is seeking to organize the employees of that employer private information about each employee, including their address, their phone number, their cell phone number, their email address, their work schedule, which is to allow the union to be able to have unfettered contact with that employee to try to convince them to support the union. And they do that by getting the employee to sign what are known as authorization cards. And if, under current law, if a union gets 30% of the employees of the employer to sign authorization cards, then that triggers a secret ballot election that is conducted by the National Labor Relations Board. What the bill would do would, first of all, say, would limit the ability of the employer to communicate with the employees about the positives and negatives about joining a union and bargaining collectively. Secondly, if let's assume this election were held and the union loses the election, they do not achieve 50% plus one of the employee support in that election. But when they collected these authorization cards, let's assume they got 50% plus one of the authorization cards, but then nevertheless lost the election. The NLRB would set aside that election and say that the signing of an authorization card trumps the secret ballot election. Now let's take a look about the environment in which those authorization cards are collected. So, an employee could walk out of the workplace and go to their car, go to the parking lot, and there are, you know, three individuals there, and they say, hey, you support the union, don't you? Why don't you sign this authorization card? Now, that could be a coercive environment, and the employee may decide to sign the authorization card just to avoid a conflict. But then when they go into the secret ballot election, they get to exercise their free will. So what the bill would do would be to say that notwithstanding the results of the secret ballot election, we're still going to impose the union upon the employees, even though they've demonstrated through free their ability of free choice to reject the union.
So the authorization card then is basically saying, okay, yeah, put it to a vote. Sure, you can put it to a vote.
It says I support the union, but that is not with the safeguards of a secret ballot election, where you have the ability to exercise your free will without anybody looking over your shoulder.
And then another thing that I know that in the materials that you sent, you speak of allowing secondary boycotts.
Right.
Which I ask, what is a secondary boycott?
Yeah. So federal labor law started in 1935 with the National Labor Relations Act. And in 1947, it was amended to outlaw what are known as secondary boycotts because of the economic disruptions that had occurred in the previous 12 years by permitting this type of activity. And very simply, a secondary boycott allows a union that has a dispute with an employer to put pressure on a secondary employer to try to compel that secondary employer not to do business with the primary employer. And let me give you an example of how that comes into play. So let's assume you have a hospital, and that hospital is building a new wing on the hospital, and the hospital hires a contractor who does not have a union agreement. And the union that wants to have the hospital built by union labor puts up a picket line at the hospital to try to pressure the hospital to cancel that contract with the contractor who they have an agreement with to build the new wing. So when they put up that picket line, that would presumably induce, let's say, the nurses union that work at the hospital to honor that picket line in solidarity with the construction union. So they decide that they're not going to go to work, which means the hospital can't operate, which puts a lot of pressure on the hospital to go to that contractor and say, either you sign the union agreement that the construction union is presenting to you, or I have to find a different contractor.
I look at some of these strikes, okay? And I look at, for instance, the General Motors strike, which, you know, coming as it did right before the pandemic, what a rough year for all of them. Mm-hmm. But, you know, they went on a strike. It was the longest strike they ever had, messed up their supply line, all kinds of people out of work. And quite frankly, mm-hmm. they wanted to go back to work because they wanted to make a living. But mm-hmm. it was the union leadership that just would not budge in a similar fashion to teachers unions right now, where there's mm-hmm. a lot of rank and file teachers that want to be in the classroom, know the right thing to do is to be in the classroom, mm-hmm. but they really have no say because they're right. not the people in charge of the union. It mm-hmm. sounds like it's the same kind of thing.
Yeah, it is. And if you want every union to have the type of leverage that the teachers union has right now, then support this legislation. I think it's also important to point out that this legislation also allows for pickets and strikes at any time and for any reason. So this would give unions, and under current law, a strike is generally only permitted when the employer has committed a violation, what's known as an unfair labor practice, or the parties have reached an impasse at collective bargaining and the union goes on strike to try to leverage the employer to acquiesce to the union demands during negotiations. But this bill would allow a union at any time to call a strike for a day, for an hour, for 4 hours, for a week, to put pressure on an employer to do what the union seeks.
Man, because, you know, the labor, I don't know who wins in a labor strike. I don't think anybody wins in a labor strike. The union bosses, I guess, win in a labor strike. Egos win in a labor strike. But management loses, ownership loses, rank and file members of the union lose. Everybody loses in a strike. So why would they want to make strikes so much easier to do? I have a feeling I know the answer to that, but I'm curious what yours is.
Well, the reason is it just gives additional economic weapons to the union that the employer has no practical way of defeating.
Well, and the thing that's interesting about – I'm sorry?
No, you go ahead, please.
The thing that's interesting about the contracting industry, you know, and a lot of these people that, you know, they start out, they work for someone else. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, they work for an HVAC company for years. It gets bought out. They go and hang up their own shingle. They hang up their own shingle as electricians or plumbers or whatever else.
Right.
And now you're saying that that also makes it very difficult for the people that actually reach the American dream, which is to put up your own shingle and work for yourself.
And take
risks. And you're someone in construction trades. Yes, and take risks.
Yeah, and take risks.
Take risks.
Yeah, and let me extrapolate on this a little bit, because there's another appeal of the onion here when you look at the bill. California, about 2 or 3 years ago, passed a sweeping reform of the definition of what an independent contractor is. And in the construction industry, a contractor will frequently hire independent owner-operators of trucks. They deliver materials. They take away waste and refuse from the site. Many of these independent owner operators of trucks are emerging firms. They're women-owned firms. They're minority-owned firms. And as you say, these are people that are taking a risk and they're trying to build a business. Well, if you pass this bill, those independent owner operators of trucks are going to be classified as employees of the general contractor, because of the control, the limited control that the general contractor exerts over that truck driver. And that limited control is based on scheduling, determining what the loads are going to be, things like that. Even though that there is a arm's length contract between the general contractor and the owner operator of that truck, that owner operator would be declared an employee of that general contractor. That's not what that man or woman wanted when they took the risk, when they bought the truck, when they, you know, set out to be in business for themselves. And now they're going to be classified as an employee of somebody that they have a contractual relationship with.
See, and that, I mean, I would think a lot of them, first of all, would want to have more than one contractor that they were working with. You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
You want to go out and get as many different jobs as you can, and are you an employee of all of them? And for the employer, you know, I mean, and this is more than the construction industry. This is any industry. You know, a lot of folks use independent contract labor because it makes sense on the bottom line. These people, I mean, the IRS definition at least used to be that if you're working for multiple people and your employer can't tell you not to work for someone else, then you can be an independent contractor. And that a lot of times makes the numbers work for the employer, for the company. And it sounds like that is, you're not going to be able to do that much.
That's correct. So So it basically cuts off an opportunity for people to go into business for themselves.
Man, and now you're obviously representing the Associated General Contractors of America. Stephen Sandher here is the CEO of that group. But really what you're talking about and the way that this is being presented out there, this would have a sweeping impact on far more than just construction. Mm-hmm.
Oh, absolutely. This affects every employer in the country that's a private sector employer.
This makes us France.
It makes us France? Yeah, it does. Yeah. Yeah. Anybody who's ever gone to Europe and thought they were getting on a train on a Tuesday morning and they show up in the station and say, sorry, there's a strike today. That's the experience that we're going to have here.
Man, so it's called the PRO Act, P-R-O, and has it gotten very far? Is it in committee? Is it on the floor yet? What's going on with that?
It's scheduled to be on the House floor next week, and it's been introduced in the Senate. There are 45 co-sponsors in the Senate, all Democrats, it is the number one priority of the AFL-CIO, and they are going to pull out all the stops to get this enacted.
Because they've done such a great job for their workers. They've done such a good job for their workers. They haven't. I'm sorry. I can't help it. I believe in unions. I think they're necessary. I think they're good. But I think that the leadership of unions is as disconnected from the people that are actually part of them as our Congress is to the people that actually live and work in this country.
Well, to look at it in a similar way, basically what this bill does is it takes a delicate balance of competing but legitimate interests, the interests of the employees to organize and bargain collectively, and the interest of the union, of the employer, to be able to manage their business and to try to make a profit. And upsets that balance by giving unions significant and additional economic weapons that defeat the whole purpose of the balanced approach that federal labor policy has had for over 80 years.
So where can people find out more about this? Obviously, you're talking to lots of folks about this to make them aware of it. Where can they find out more of what you've written about it? And also, where can they find out more about this particular legislation?
Yeah, they can go to our website, advocacy.agc.org, and they can learn a lot more about the various elements that are in this bill.
All right. Well, I want to thank you so much, and I hope you have a fantabulous weekend, sir.
Thank you. You too, Diane. Appreciate the conversation. Take care.
Yeah, likewise. Thank you. And man, oh, man.